Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Losing a pregnancy can be devastating, and it is never easy to talk about. But as common as miscarriage is, it remains a deeply private pain. More women, though, are talking about it, and sometimes in very public ways. For example, Michelle Obama opened up about her miscarriage in her 2018 book, Becoming. So has Alanis Morissette and Beyoncé. And here's Meghan McCain talking about her miscarriage on The View last October.
Oftentimes, as people turn into the show, they probably think that, you know, we're leading these, like, perfect lives and everything's wonderful. And there's actually a lot of intensity in any human's life. And I just thought after I had my miscarriage that I should talk about it because everything I go through, I just want people to feel less alone because I felt very, very alone during the entire experience. And afterward, I just felt like I have this huge platform. Why not use it to help other women feel less alone?
Well, today, we want to continue that conversation and open up more space to talk about miscarriages, about how common they are and the impact they have on women and their loved ones. So this hour On Point, destigmatizing miscarriage. And we definitely want to hear from you if your story, if you or someone you love had a miscarriage and what happened in the immediate aftermath. Did you feel isolated and alone? Did you feel guilty? What can we all do to make this common experience, this unfortunately common experience, less taboo to talk about? Join us online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us from Houston, Texas today is Sunita Osborne. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and author of the book, The Miscarriage Map, What to Expect When You Are No Longer Expecting. Sunita, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Also with us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Dr. Stacey Beck. She's an obstetrician-gynecologist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, McGee Women's Hospital. Dr. Beck, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Sunita, I wonder if I could, and if you would, if we could just start with your personal story, your personal experience with miscarriage.
Sure. Yeah, my experience with miscarriage started in 2018. My husband and I talked about getting pregnant, and we got pregnant in September 2018 and found out we were having a miscarriage by that October. And I will say that, you know, you talk a lot about that devastation, that shock that you have afterwards. And it certainly was the case for me. While I knew that miscarriage was a possibility, I had counseled so many of my clients through it. It was definitely something else, a different experience being on the other side of the therapeutic couch. And I felt just really lost and really alone. And I did what I usually did in those moments when I don't really know where to turn is I looked for books. I looked for resources to help me get a sense of how do I walk through this new journey that I never expected that I was going to be on. And I started looking for resources. I started looking for just other women's stories to help me know that I'm not alone. Because I think it is so true that when you're in that space, when you're alone, it's almost like a breeding ground in a sense for shame and a host of other really just painful feelings. So yeah. I just wanted to know, what am I going through? Is it normal? Have other people gone through this? And if so, how did they get through this? And that's where I started actually kind of writing some of my journey and started writing what I was going through. And as my journey evolved, so did the chapters of a book that I began writing during that same time.
Yeah. You know, there are so many facets to this terrible experience. Obviously, there's medical and physical ones, and we'll talk about that. But there's also I don't know what the right word is. Is it the emotional whiplash, right? Because you're sort of in this moment where you've had news that you've joyful news that you,
yes.
that you wanted and had hoped for, that one wants and hopes for, and then you sort of imagine the whole rest of your new life mapped out in front of you, right? And then all of a sudden, that all gets ripped, taken away. Like all of a sudden,
Right.
Is that how it felt for you?
It really did. You know, I can just tell you, I very vividly remember that moment when we were in the doctor's office. We were looking at the ultrasound, and just moments before, my husband and I were talking about possible names. We were just dreaming on the drive there to the office. And then within a moment, a few words can just change the course of your life by them saying that we don't see a heartbeat anymore. And I've heard many women talk about this, that in that moment, things move from really fast to almost like slow motion, in a sense, where it's hard to grasp the reality of what you've just been told. And I will say that up and down, that emotional whiplash, I think is a great phrase for it. It just continues where you go back and forth between anger and shock and sadness and fear. And honestly, all within the same day. I don't think there's any kind of normal reaction we can have after this, because everything is kind of going up and down. And I would say that's normal. Emotional whiplash, all of that is so normal after that experience.
Well, Dr. Beck, let me turn to you here. I mean, I imagine that you've had to, that you've had many patients who've experienced this, right?
Correct. Yes. Unfortunately, I have dealt with this fairly regularly.
Mm. And so what, in that moment when you or other members of your team have to communicate what's happening, like how do you handle that moment?
I think it doesn't get easier, even for having done this for 15 plus years. I think you really have to kind of individualize how you present that information to the patient based on kind of whether it's your few moments that you're meeting them or you have a relationship with them, and try and give them this devastating news in as compassionate a way as possible. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's an easy way to, you know, let somebody down with such a traumatic piece of information, mm-hmm. especially when, as Sunita said, you know, you're there and the couple's there or a woman is there. And, you know, in that moment, she's excited to see her baby's heartbeat. And she has all these visions of, you know, her future life as a mother. And she is probably very excited every time she goes to the doctor's office. And then just to have something come to a crashing halt is just a very emotionally complex experience for a woman to go through.
Well, we're going to talk about why it's so difficult to talk about and why it seems that it's for a long time been rather taboo, even that people feel like they can't share this this event that has happened to them. But Dr. Beck, let's undergird that conversation with some medical facts. I mean, miscarriage is this is one of the great ironies, right? That miscarriage is actually very common. And how common is it?
Miscarriage is extremely common. So for the general population, on average, the risk for a miscarriage any time that a woman conceives is anywhere from about 15 to 30%. Depending on a woman's age when she conceives, that risk could be slightly lower than that or significantly higher.
You were saying that it varies given on age certainly isn't the only variable that might affect the possibility of miscarriage.
Correct. There are many other risk factors that contribute, but age is probably one of the strongest links to a drastic difference in miscarriage rate.
Mm. And I don't want to say that we should be focusing on one trimester over the other, but do miscarriage rates go up or down depending on the trimester?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Great question. So more commonly, the risk for miscarriage is highest below 12 weeks, which would be considered an early pregnancy loss. At that time, the risk, again, is upwards of 30%. As you get beyond 13 weeks to about 15 to 16 weeks, that risk goes down to about 5%. And then the quoted risk for miscarriage between 16 and 20 weeks is arguably about 1 to 2%.
Okay. You know, it suddenly occurred to me that I should ask you a very important but basic question, okay? How should we best define what a miscarriage is?
I think that is a very great question. And I think it's actually debated in the medical community. So I think the kind of generic accepted answer to that question is that a miscarriage is a loss of pregnancy anytime before 20 weeks. And that's actually really interesting because there's not a medical or biological explanation why 20 weeks was kind of arbitrarily chosen, as if you lose your pregnancy before 20 weeks, it's a miscarriage. And if you lose your pregnancy after 20 weeks, it's considered a stillbirth.
Mm.
I think that particularly as you move beyond 15 weeks in the pregnancy, the line that is crossed between a miscarriage and a stillbirth is not black and white. I think it's a very gray mixed area. And so there are, within the definition or scope of miscarriage, there are different accepted types of miscarriage. And so the most common that a patient actually presents to the hospital with would be what's called a missed miscarriage or a missed abortion, mm-hmm. where the woman is actually not having any symptoms, not having any bleeding or cramping, and she presents to her doctor's office for a routine visit. And on ultrasound or assessment of the baby's heart rate, they no longer see a fetal heart rate. And so obviously, again, not that any type of miscarriage is less devastating, but obviously this is coming as a complete shock to this patient who is otherwise feeling fine and just obviously thrown into emotional roller coaster with the information. There are women who present with symptoms that are very concerning for a miscarriage, where they are having significant cramping and bleeding.
Yeah.
And when they present to their doctor, there is still, you know, pregnancy tissue or pregnancy products inside of their uterus. And so they have not completely passed or miscarried. And that's called an incomplete abortion. And then a complete miscarriage would be when a patient, unfortunately, has a miscarriage, whether it be at home or on arrival to the hospital. And by the time an ultrasound is done, the contents of the uterus have completely been evacuated.
Mm. Let's acknowledge the care with which you had to talk through that, right? Because part of the issue here is that, how do I say this? That that we're living in a world where the personal can become the political. Okay,
yes.
And I don't necessarily want to drag politics into any of this. So I want to say thank you for walking us through that in the way that you did. But Sunita, we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a break. Do you think this is one of the reasons why people are still kind of a little afraid to open up about their experiences?
I think that certainly can play a factor for sure. I think as a society in general, we're ill-equipped to deal with grief and just even in general kind of more sensitive issues. So at times people feel like maybe it's better I just don't say anything at all. But again, that can be a really lonely place to take, both for an individual and the whole family as a whole. So I'm glad we're having conversations like this.
Well, Sunita Osborne and Dr. Stacey Beck will be back in just a moment. We are talking about creating spaces to have conversations about miscarriage. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about destigmatizing miscarriage and creating more spaces to talk about it publicly. I'm joined today by Sunita Osborne. She is a licensed clinical psychologist and author of The Miscarriage Map, What to Expect When You Are No Longer Expecting. Dr. Stacey Beck also joins us. She's an OBGYN at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, McGee Women's Hospital. Sunita, you were talking about your personal experience suffering a miscarriage here. Can you tell us more about that emotional roller coaster that you were on in the immediate aftermath? Because oftentimes, we hear about women, their family, their partners, people suffering this like sense of shame.
Yes.
Guilt?
Yeah, I certainly had those feelings after. And so I had two miscarriages. I had one in October of 2018, and then I had my second miscarriage in March of 2019. So I will say I was definitely experiencing some of that emotional whiplash where soon after my first miscarriage, I had these kind of just different ideas. And I think this is a common misconception that a lot of women experience, is that did I do something to cause this? Mm. Was it that hot shower I took, or was I maybe not supposed to eat that specific type of cheese, or maybe it wasn't okay that I had a cup of coffee, even though my doctor said it. And as much as my rational mind could tell me, like, no, all of those things were okay, again, I think it's really easy to go into that place of shame when I'm not hearing enough stories that say, like, this is such a normal experience. It's normal that you're going to feel guilt and sadness and shame and anger and a whole host of other painful emotions to experience. And I think that can just feel really exhausting to have to kind of go through all those ups and downs. And on top of that, I think a really difficult emotion or experience that a lot of people can have is also questioning that reaction. Having this idea of like, am I making this too big? Why am I having this when I don't see anyone else talking about this? I don't see anyone else being this devastated. And that's a question I asked myself very often after my first miscarriage. And I will say, apart from all the other emotions, that was probably the most painful to deal with. The idea of wondering, am I making too big a deal about this experience?
Ah, okay. So how long did that tension stay within you?
You know, I think what really helped me was actually both writing the book and being able to listen to some of these great podcasts out there, like the Life After Miscarriage podcast, the Managing Miscarriage podcast, where women are sharing their stories. And they were talking about walking through all the same steps that I had walked through, where they felt angry at times at like, why did this have to happen? To me, felt sad and they felt devastated and wondered if they would ever be able to feel any differently than they were feeling. I think another thing that really helped is both my husband and I were really open after our experiences of miscarriages. We both did not really subscribe to the 12-week rule of waiting to tell people that we were pregnant, just because we knew that if the worst was to happen, we wanted everyone's support there. We didn't want to have to keep that all to ourselves. And one thing that really helped is each time we would have a conversation with someone sharing about our miscarriage, it was shocking the number of people who would share, oh, me too. Mm-hmm. I've also had that experience, or my mom had that experience, or my sister, or my wife, my partner, whatever else. And I think having those conversations just made me feel like, wow, I am not alone here. And you know what? I'm not making this too big.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Beck, I want to read a comment to you that we've gotten received from a listener here. Because she really, Hannah, our listener, really sort of hits home on this idea of the unique messages that women get when they're pregnant about their responsibility for the health of the fetus. So Hannah says, as a regular rock climber, my doctor gave me the green light to continue this sport early in pregnancy as long as I dialed back the intensity. When I miscarried cliffside, my husband noted that I should make it clear to my family and friends that we told that while I miscarried while rock climbing, I didn't miscarry because I was rock climbing. That is the stigma I felt that others would blame my loss on my activity. And then she says, pregnant women are told to avoid so many things, alcohol, sushi, etc. It's no wonder that after we miscarry, we sometimes worry it was our fault or that others may think it was. Dr. Beck, what do you think about that?
I think what she's saying is extremely valid. We definitely live in a society where, as women, when we go through a miscarriage, there's this immense sense of shame, and as you know, as both of you have said, this sense of responsibility that we did something wrong to cause this. And I think a large part of that is because people don't talk about what truly are the causes that are known and related to miscarriage. And so it's not well understood in the general population. I think also some of that comes from our you know, there's just a large body or lack of evidence as to, you know, what causes miscarriage for a large percentage of women. And unfortunately, that I think falls into a bigger picture of just a lack of research in general into women's health issues and in particular pregnancy related issues.
So you sort of began to answer a question I was going to ask you, which is, you know, these things that Hannah was pointing out about all the things women are told to avoid or the ways they're advised to change how they live their lives. I mean, do we know at all if these are potential or not doing these things are potential causes of miscarriage?
I assume you're in particular talking about like activity.
Yeah, I mean, she was talking about
physical activity.
Like, she was told about, you know, like, when women are told don't eat this, that, and the other, don't drink this, change this activity, obviously there's the smoking, drinking, drug, I mean, all of that. You get this whole like panoply of advice on yeah, how to live your life when you find out that you're pregnant.
Shockingly, most of our understanding of things that do or don't have an effect on the risk of miscarriage is actually from really old studies, kind of really poorly designed studies, so not actually strong evidence. I think the circumstances or the things that we do have a strong sense are potentially related. Even then, if you look at those studies, most of them are kind of looking back in time at women and looking at things that they were exposed to or things that happened to them. And when you see a consistent trend in studies of certain things, you correlate them to a risk of miscarriage. But very few things have been definitively linked to causing a significant increased risk of miscarriage. And that's kind of where, as physicians and scientists, we say, again, for most studies, there's a strong difference between something correlating as a risk and something causing a risk.
I see. So I really appreciate this, because this is the kind of basic education we need, right? That's part of the reason why it's so hard to talk about this, because people don't know you know, what we know and what we don't know. But let me ask you, I mean, I had always thought that one of the primary causes, reasons, I don't know what the best word is, for miscarriages early in pregnancy is that, you know, perhaps there's something sort of catastrophically wrong with the fetus at that time, genetically. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. So when you, particularly when you look at what I was describing earlier as an early pregnancy loss before 12 weeks, arguably 70% of those pregnancies are related to either a lethal genetic abnormality or a chromosomal abnormality, where it is accepted in the medical community that if the pregnancy were to progress, it would result in the birth of either a stillborn or a child that has significant medical issues that is highly likely not to be compatible with life, even if the patient didn't miscarry.
So, Sunita, let me ask you about that, because this is, again, one of those razor's edge things, right? Like especially when it happens early in pregnancy, that there's every possibility it's because of the lack of viability. So perhaps, you know, it's a – I want to call it a gift. Do you see how I'm struggling here? Mm-hmm, I just don't know how to talk about this, but it's quote-unquote for the best, and yet it's still this loss. So, like, how do you balance that? How did you balance that?
You know, and I think this is really speaking to the complexity of miscarriage. It's interesting. I published an article recently talking about miscarriage, and one of the comments I had gotten was someone essentially sharing, I don't understand why anyone could be upset about a miscarriage, because isn't this evolution? Isn't this Darwin's way of saying survival of the fittest? And, you know, I can, as hurtful as that comment could be, at the same time, I can hear what this person is trying to say, this idea that, yes, isn't this just part of like genetics and evolution? And at the same time, this is incredibly painful for people. This is still a loss. And I think part of the work that I would do, that I did for myself and with my clients, is being able to hold both of those things at the same time, that loss is never going to be simple at all, that it's going to be complicated and confusing. And there's so many different pieces. And can we bring all of them into the room and make space for all of that, that it's valid that this happened. And it's also valid that you're still feeling that loss, that you're still feeling like you wanted this life to happen, that you had all these hopes and dreams that deserve to be mourned, even with the medical reality of what happened as well, too. So I think you can hold both at the same time, but it just shows the complexity of this issue. It makes it really hard to really process fully.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're actually getting a lot of comments online here. Really interesting one coming in from Jen McManamy. Jen, if you hear this, I'm so sorry if I just did not do well on your last name. But Jen says, it takes a while to recover from a miscarriage. That feelings and heartbreak aside, the physical consequences are not only painful, but may require surgery that comes with weeks of controlling bleeding. I mean, Dr. Beck, we should talk about that. Like, what are the potential medical complications or after effects of the miscarriage itself?
So ultimately, it depends, again, what type of miscarriage somebody has. So as I said, probably one of the more common circumstances that we see a woman miscarrying is when she has still has the fetus without a heartbeat inside of her uterus. And how that's managed, there are different options. There's kind of, you can expectantly manage it and allow the woman to have her body naturally pass the pregnancy. You can offer medication assistance so that you hopefully expedite the process of her uterus evacuating the tissue, or the patient can opt to have surgery. And again, in that can be individualized to the patient's preferences. In the circumstance where a patient decides to wait, it can be weeks and weeks before she actually passes tissue. And so that buildup, that, you know, I hate to say the word suspense because that's probably an inappropriate word, but that it kind of not knowing and that anticipation of if and when you're going to start bleeding, will I be at work? Will I be around people who I don't want them to know this is happening to me? That anticipation is, I think, dreadful probably for patients. There definitely is a fair percentage of women who still want to kind of trust that their body's doing what it's supposed to do and choose that pathway. But for those women in particular who, you know, want their body to take the natural course, there is a higher risk that not all of the tissue will pass. And so one of the most common complications of miscarriage that we see is that the patient needs some additional procedure to help remove the additional tissue so that they're not at an increased risk of excessive bleeding or infection.
And we're hearing that sometimes not all of those procedures may be covered by insurance.
I think, I will adamantly say I'm not an insurance expert for certain, okay. But I think in the circumstance of either a missed abortion or an incomplete abortion, I would have a hard time seeing an insurance company not paying for it, versus it might come down to the fine line of the physician documenting appropriately that this is not an elective abortion, yeah. Which is obviously a very drastically different procedure. Mm-hmm. There is obviously, if patients have copays, there may be varying different levels of copays. And unfortunately, that may steer people's decision making and how they manage the circumstance, which is really unfortunate that they might not get to choose how they want to manage it based on copays and deductibles.
Gosh, indeed. You know, Sunita, just to shift gears a tiny bit here, we've got actually quite a few comments from folks talking about how hard it is to, in the aftermath of a miscarriage, also given that so many women are working as well. Like, mm-hmm. For example, Sammy True says, I remember being laid off during a miscarriage. She wants to hear and experience a more compassionate side of the workforce for a change. And then Carol Cutter Gonzalez sent us this message on Facebook. She says, I was very lucky. My employer was incredibly understanding when I was suffering through my miscarriages. I can't even imagine how much harder it would have been if I was also worried about losing my job and my income. Mm-hmm. And then Carol rightly points out that with the amount of American women now working in low wage or shift work, it's undeniable that millions of women could be suffering through miscarriages and at risk of losing employment because of it. What do you think about that?
Right. And I have seen, I'd say, the whole spectrum of reactions, where there are some jobs and bosses who are incredibly understanding. They support the woman in taking time off. They maybe even support the partner from taking time off because there is that physical and emotional recovery that needs to happen. And then I've heard a lot of women who they're so afraid that I can't actually leave work. I have to be there. And they may be even literally having some of like the miscarriage while they're at work at the same time, which can be, of course, quite traumatizing as well. So I think it just serves to almost compound some of the grief and pain that they're dealing with, that I don't even have the time or space to be able to process this right now because I have to go to work. I have to provide for my family. And again, I think that message that our workforce actually can send us the message that it is not okay for us to take the time to grieve this. It almost invalidates maybe some of the pain that we could be experiencing if we are told that we don't need the space to go home and think about this and process this and rest from this as well.
Do you see any kind of shift in even if it's in tiny sectors of the American workplace in sort of recognizing that perhaps people need more time? I mean, I'm seeing some companies here. Reddit gives eight and a half paid weeks to employees who've had a pregnancy loss.
I do think it's starting to happen. And I think particularly in some companies, and I will say some that I'm just more personally aware of because of family and friends, like tech companies like Salesforce, things like that, who have been more mindful of just the different kind of losses that people may experience, giving more of that time specific to pregnancy loss. I'll say I think that's something that's slowly starting to evolve because it is more often happening in other countries like Australia and UK. They have so much support when it comes to miscarriage and pregnancy loss. And I think that there is like these kind of tiny shifts like you're speaking of where we are starting to catch up in giving miscarriage and pregnancy loss the support and space that it deserves.
Well, we are talking this hour about destigmatizing miscarriage, and I'm joined today by Sunita Osborne. She's author of The Miscarriage Map, What to Expect When You're No Longer Expecting. And Dr. Stacey Beck also joins us. She's an OBGYN at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, McGee Women's Hospital. And again, like I said, lots of comments coming in here. Nancy says, I experienced multiple miscarriages, a stillbirth and premature labor that almost resulted in the loss of my son, who fortunately was born healthy. I mostly recovered from the grief and have enjoyed a happy family life, but 51 years later, I still weep on the anniversary of the night I lost my daughter at 7 months. It's a sadness that doesn't heal and doesn't deserve all the nastiness. So we'll talk about the long-term effects when we come back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunha was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about destigmatizing miscarriage. And I'm joined today by Sunita Osborne. She is author of The Miscarriage Map, What to Expect When You Are No Longer Expecting. Dr. Stacey Beck also joins us. She's an OBGYN at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, McGee Women's Hospital. And Sunita, just before the break, I read that comment that came in from Nancy, who she said that it's been more than 50 years since she lost a pregnancy at 7 months. And it's still, she still carries that pain with her. I mean, it seems like we've had other comments coming in saying that, like, people have experienced a form of PTSD, long-term PTSD from that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. And I will say there is a specific word for the miscarriage when it comes to trauma. It's called a reproductive trauma. And we see for a lot of women that they experience symptoms of PTSD following a miscarriage, where they experience flashbacks. They are hypersensitive to triggers. They experience anxiety, depression, just a lot of the same symptoms that we would see with someone who experienced any kind of life-threatening trauma. And I will say, so speaking to Nancy's experience, that is something that I've heard a lot of clients mention as well, too. Just the idea that years, sometimes decades later, they still have this experience of what we would call at times like almost unresolved grief, where if I didn't get the chance to actually even process what was going on for me, that it still is with me. And even if I did get that chance, I still feel that pain, especially around anniversaries or other kind of reminders of my loss. So I will say it is a painful but not uncommon experience that for a lot of women, a lot of individuals, this loss, it really stays with them for potentially most of their life.
Well, Dr. Beck, I wonder what you think about that, because with any major medical news that a person receives in a hospital setting, I mean, there is a conversation about whether sort of immediate counseling, mental health assistance, sort of a more a holistic team approach to supporting that person in the moment should be happening in the hospital. I mean, should that be happening around miscarriage?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, again, even though it can kind of going back to the sentiment that the last commenter made about having a miscarriage and then a stillbirth and then, you know, a pregnancy complication. And although medically those are very different things, I think our society has kind of siloed miscarriage and stillbirth and expect women to have two different experiences in relationship to that, almost such that we expect women to, you know, get over a miscarriage faster because it happened earlier, and have less of an expectation of that in women with a stillbirth. But both of them are still the loss of your child. Yes, you're bonding with your child may be very different if you've lost your pregnancy at 12 weeks versus made it to 7 months and have been feeling your baby move and been having full conversations with your baby, but it's still the loss of your child. And just as no one ever would look at a mother or a father and tell them to get over the loss of the grief of their 2-year-old or their 22-year-old, I would never expect for a woman to ever forget about the pain of losing a child, no matter when she lost the pregnancy. I think it's a matter of learning to deal with those emotions and cope with it. So then to go back and answer the question you actually asked, I think as a healthcare system, we need to do better at offering women not only immediate support, but ongoing support. I think that people are now starting to recognize that and trying to create healthcare systems where we can offer some support. I think, unfortunately, the insurance funding for counseling, therapy, doulas, doulas that specialize in pregnancy loss and grief, the funding for it is very lacking. And so I think healthcare systems struggle with this.
Yeah. You know, we have been focusing thus far on the impact on the woman who loses the pregnancy. But of course, in many situations, the impact reverberates through that person's, the whole family. So I want to just play a moment here. This is actor James Vanderbeek, and he opened up about his wife Kimberly's miscarriage on ABC's Dancing with the Stars back in November.
My wife Kimberly and I went through every expectant parent's worst nightmare. We lost the baby. All you know is that it brings you closer together. It breaks you open. It opens up your heart. Deepens your appreciation.
It's James Vanderbeek on ABC's Dancing with the Stars. Sunita, would you be willing to tell us a little bit about the impact that your pregnancy losses had on your husband?
Yeah, we certainly did struggle after our first and our second miscarriage in the sense that we were both having really different experiences to the loss. And I think part of that is compounded by the fact that partners, and my husband specifically, they don't always get the same kind of support that women do in this situation. They're not always asked the same questions or given the same amount of space. And I think for us, a lot of what happened was in the beginning, I was so devastated. I was in such a state of almost like a fog where he really kind of jumped into the role of being like, okay, the problem solver, helping me schedule appointments, coming with me to all of my appointments and really being there for me. And at the same time, at times I felt kind of surprised that it felt like he wasn't really experiencing the same depth of pain that I was experiencing. And what we found out through couples therapy, and I'm a little biased here, but I'm a huge supporter of both individual and couples therapy, especially after a loss like this, was that my husband was so focused on taking care of me and making sure that I was okay in that time that he had essentially like pushed his grief, his reaction to the side to focus on my needs. And it wasn't until months later that he started experiencing grief, that he started to actually acknowledge the pain that he had and all the dreams and the hopes that for our child that hadn't happened for him. But it took him months. And this is an experience a lot of partners have of experiencing delayed grief because they're so focus on wanting to help their partner that they don't really talk about what's going on with them. And I think the danger in that is that we see that couples can really struggle after a miscarriage because one partner, typically the women in a heterosexual couple, feel like their male partner isn't really showing the same level of sadness or pain that they're experiencing, and they feel really disconnected from them. And again, that can a lot of times be because the male partner is so fixated on, I just want to help you. I want to support you. I don't want my feelings to get in the way here. But on the contrary, they can really bring a couple closer together, which is what it really did for us. Like my husband sharing his pain, his grief, allowed us to walk through this together, which is what we both really needed.
Mm. Well, we started this conversation with just observing that a lot of very high-profile people over the past couple of years have been willing to speak more publicly about their experience with miscarriage. So, I mean, for example, here's former First Lady Michelle Obama. She discussed having a miscarriage. She wrote about it in her 2018 memoir, Becoming. And in an interview with ABC News that November, she said more.
I felt lost and alone, and I felt like I failed because I didn't know how common miscarriages were, because we don't talk about them. We sit in our own pain thinking that somehow we're broken.
That's former First Lady Michelle Obama. Beyonce revealed in 2013 that she had a miscarriage prior to then later giving birth to her first child, Blue Ivy. And she told Oprah Winfrey in an interview that she chose to make her story public to help others. And Beyonce said she was scared during her pregnancy with Blue Ivy about another possibility, or possibility of another miscarriage, if she performed on stage. But her doctor did tell her to live her life.
It's one of the reasons I did not share I was pregnant the second time, because, mm-hmm. you don't know what's mm-hmm. going to happen. And that was hard because all of my family and my friends knew, and we celebrated, and it was hard. And I'm not the only person that goes through that. So many people go through it. And in the end, I have my daughter, mm-hmm. and there is hope.
Beyonce is speaking to Oprah Winfrey. Dr. Beck, I was going to ask both of you about sort of whether it's making a difference that more high-profile people are talking about this, and I'll get to that in a second. But in hearing both Michelle Obama and Beyonce, it occurred to me that I must ask you if, you know, there's so much evidence that African-American women, they disproportionately suffer negative outcomes in terms of maternal health for a lot of different reasons. Does that also apply with miscarriage? Do they suffer a higher prevalence of miscarriage?
There seems to be less of an effect on race in the data that exists. But I think, unfortunately, there's a really big lack of understanding on this particular pregnancy complication, because there's a large percentage of women who have miscarriages who either weren't even aware they were pregnant. Mm-hmm. So it was such an early pregnancy loss. So that those numbers, that percentage of women is actually lost, or that they don't have adequate access to healthcare or resources. And so unfortunately deal with the trauma and the experience of having a miscarriage without even ever presenting to a healthcare provider, either because they were ashamed they were pregnant, they didn't have insurance to cover it, they didn't have transportation to get there. So it is likely probably a larger factor than what our current understanding appreciates.
Well, given how common miscarriage is and the impact that it has on women and their families, why isn't there more research being done on it?
I think for several reasons. I think first, again, is because of the kind of historical difficulty in getting funding in women's research to begin with. So that would be number one. Obviously, again, I'm kind of blessed in being working at a facility where we have an amazing research institute right here at our fingertips. And so I do get the privilege of working with phenomenal scientists and physicians who are doing kind of the forefront of research on pregnancy complications and loss. But researchers getting funding to do this is difficult. And secondly, historically, ethically performing research studies in pregnancy is hard, particularly when you're dealing with the types of studies that really need to be done to understand how a pregnancy implants normally, why it doesn't implant normally. And then you really get on a big ethical slippery slope of what is allowed and what's not allowed.
You can't go around doing double blind studies on pregnant women, for sure. I completely understand that. That is a forever complication here. Sunita Osborne, to this issue of it seems as if over the past couple of years we've been hearing more high-profile people very publicly talk about their miscarriages. Do you think that's making a difference? Are we starting to see a cultural shift?
I do think it is making a difference. I have heard several clients describe just hearing people like Michelle Obama, who they greatly admire, sharing her story makes such a difference for them, makes them feel less alone. And I think it just does such a huge shift in sharing a different kind of narrative. I think the narrative that we receive a lot of the time is the idea of a happy, successful pregnancy, to the point that a lot of times when someone finds out that they're pregnant, it's automatically, okay, pregnancy equals baby. The idea that this narrative could look differently, the idea that people, again, that we really look up to could have lived this narrative and then also survived it, can just be incredibly helpful for people. So I do think it's making a huge difference that these high profile figures are using their platform to, again, just promote more dialogue around this very universal issue.
So let's spend the last couple of minutes here trying to look forward with compassion and advice and hope, right? So, I mean, Sunita, if someone's experiencing a miscarriage, like, what's your first piece of advice to them on after receiving medical attention about what they should do to get the kind of support that we've been talking about?
I think the first thing that comes to my mind is to be able to tell someone it is okay that you are not feeling okay. A lot of times I'll tell clients that normal you takes a back seat after a miscarriage. It is okay to feel like you are in a fog, to feel a whole host of emotions, again, all maybe within the same day, within the same hour as well. And I think as much as you can, being able to reach out to people for support, whether that is friends, family, partner, coworkers, or even if it just means like I need to listen to this podcast like this, that people are talking about miscarriage, it can be incredibly helpful. Because I think there really is a danger at times in just staying in the silence, because that can, like I said earlier, be a breeding ground for shame, another host of just really isolating, painful experiences. So I guess my first advice or first suggestion would be to reach out to other people and to, again, know that it is okay to not be okay after this.
And are there any books? Because we've had some commenters writing in saying that they found a lot of aid in certain books, literature. I mean, aside from your own, of course.
Right. Yeah, I think there are some really great books out there. There's one that I think that's just called Miscarriage. There's another great one by a psychologist called Unsung Lullabies, which I really enjoy. There's a couple of great podcasts, the Managing Miscarriage podcast and the Life After Miscarriage podcast. And something else I think that's really helpful is there's a number of great online, like Facebook support groups as well, too, where women are sharing their stories, sharing just different challenges that they're dealing with every day of, for example, I had to go back to work and there was a baby shower. That was so hard to deal with, and people giving support. So I think now there is, fortunately, a number of different resources that we can tap into as we're walking through this loss.
And Dr. Beck, I presume there are many people listening who might want to know if there are things that they can do early in pregnancy to prevent miscarriages. I mean, there was a time where, was there certain medication that was given? Is that done anymore?
So I would say historically, if women were having recurrent miscarriages, there was this kind of medical concept of them having a progesterone deficiency. But more recent, larger studies have suggested that this progesterone deficiency, or medically what's considered a luteal phase defect, is not really an acknowledged medical deficiency. And so the current understanding of the benefit of progesterone and reducing the risk for miscarriage suggests that it's not beneficial. I think the important thing for women to understand is, in the majority of circumstances with a miscarriage, it is not preventable. I think the only key thing to really emphasize for women in general is optimizing their health and trying as hard as they can to really plan their pregnancy. That way, if they have any underlying medical conditions such as diabetes or hypertension, that it is as well controlled as possible before they get pregnant, and that the medications that they are on are the most appropriate ones to be on when they're pregnant.
Well, Dr. Stacey Beck, OBGYN at the University of Pittsburgh's Medical Center, McGee Women's Hospital, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Sunita Osborne, author of The Miscarriage Map. It was really great to have you on the show, Sunita. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.